Newton's cradle, or, as someone said recently, Newton's balls. What does this have to do with physics? Well, one of the interesting things about this is that these balls pop out the end very quickly. And I hope to explain why I think this is kind of like a fundamental thing of life. Kind of like a fundamental thing that's going on in life related to this Newton's cradle principle of something coming in one side and going shooting out the other side seemingly right away. So my name is Floyd Maxwell, and this is Spring and Loop Theory is what I've called this. You're not seeing me because I don't want you to be distracted by, you know, a person, physical appearance. I'm trying to present a new theory of physics. This is my blackboard, and I need to be able to use my hands and to show you some of the ways in which this theory works, because I'm just not a computer graphics guy, and I haven't got some slick computer models to wow you with. So, for all the cynics, let's call this a very boring, very amateurish video on physics. Let's call it that, and let's accept that, and then let's move on. So, why is this video being made? Isn't physics perfect? Isn't it all worked out? Well, it's actually amazing how much of physics is not worked out. I always think of gravity itself, because imagine, there are four fundamental forces, one of them is gravity, and we don't know what gravity is. We know the effects of it, we know how to measure the effects, we know places where there's high gravity or heavy gravity, like a black hole, we know places where there's less gravity or no gravity. If you get into empty space, then it has no gravity, but we don't know how the whole thing works. The biggest thing for me about gravity, the biggest puzzle that I had was, virtually every force in life is repulsive. Think of it like a conflict. Like all movies seem to have a conflict. A conflict is a collision, an explosion, an outward flow of energy from this person and a flow from this person, and then they collide. That's the average force, typical force. Gravity says, come here, come here. And gravity wants to attract something. Gravity can attract something in empty space. How on earth can it do that? How could? And then, of course, modern explanation of physics says, well, space is warped and, what do they call it? Warped and bent. Warped and curved is what they say by gravity. Well, warping is not exactly a scientific term. In fact, I'm frankly amazed they use it. Curved, okay, that's getting more scientific. The problem is the way they show it, especially when you say warped, it sort of implies that gravity can make things all kind of like wavy. Like when you go to the circus or the amusement park and they have that mirror and you stand in the mirror and your whole body looks all wavy. Well, I don't think gravity does that. I think that gravity contracts space, locally compresses space. And when I say locally, I mean at an extremely small scale. And the effect that has on the space around it is what we call gravity. So that's kind of like the base premise of my whole theory is based around a reconception, a new conception of gravity. Trying to say, what is gravity? This is what gravity is. And then, what are the effects of that? So, one of the challenges with my theory is, I don't know where to start. To me, there are so many problems in physics. It's almost no matter where you turn, there are problems in physics. Today, this morning, I was on Wikipedia, and I counted 100 there's a page on Wikipedia which says, what are the big problems in physics? And I counted no less than 148 questions on that page. 148 questions related to the biggest problems in physics. That really surprised me. Honestly, that really surprised me. I was thinking there would be a top 10, you know, 5 to 10 to 15 different things. I started writing down and I could think of half a dozen. There's really no end to problems. And to me, it clearly shows that there needs to be a breakthrough in physics. There needs to be a reimagining of how physical systems work at a fundamental level, not the surface level. We got pretty well nailed. That's how we can make this beautiful surface here, this wood countertop. We got all the physics nailed on it. You know, we know about gluing, we know about leveling it, and planing it, and growing the trees, and harvesting the trees, and internal combustion engines, and all that stuff. We're great on that stuff. But when you get down below what we think of as the normal sort of bottom level of atoms and quarks and whatnot, we know almost nothing. Atoms, quarks seem to be a pretty small scale of things, but you can go down another, 10 orders of magnitude. You can go maybe it's even more, I forget the exact number, but it's, you can go many factors smaller than an atom before you get to the sort of the indivisible point, what they call the Planck scale. And that's considered currently to be the sort of the real limit. The real smallest thing is the Planck scale, the Planck size, the Planck length, the Planck mass, Planck time. Those are the real smallest gradations, the real smallest measurements. So between our everyday life and our atomic life and the Planck scale, we're actually missing a whole chunk of physics. We really have virtually no clue, except we've got all little like tidbits. It's like someone took a sheet of paper with all this subatomic scale physics on it, and they shredded it, and then they've been letting us get the odd bit of confetti and look at and examine the odd bit of confetti, like virtual particles. Or we have quantum mechanics, which says that, you know, when you try and compress an electron into a smaller and smaller space, it will break out of that space. And we're like, wow, that's cool. Imagine that, you know. I wonder how do you explain that? Or when you take photons and fire them through two slits, and you fire the photon, one photon every 10 seconds, they will still make it a diffraction pattern, a constructive and destructive interference pattern on the other side of the slit. In other words, they'll make a pattern that you normally only associate with waves, like waves on the beach, waves interacting with each other and canceling each other and making each other bigger. So how do we get these waves when we're sending one photon, one unit, every 10 seconds? How is one unit every 10 seconds equal to a wave, which is continuous, right? A wave is made of water, trillions and trillions of particles of water all working together. How can one be the other? And so we've got these crumbs of knowledge here in this subatomic world, and also in the really big world, the macroscopic world, the world much bigger than, you know, life on Earth as we think of it, the world of the sun, and even bigger things, the galaxy, and even more massive things like supermassive black holes and all that. Well, it turns out when we get to that end of the physics scale, things break down too. So we kind of have a comfort zone, and in our comfort zone, things are very well nailed down. And then outside of our comfort zone, frankly, it's kind of embarrassing. Almost no matter what theory you want to side with, you want to side with relativity, you'll run into quantum mechanics will throw you a curve. You want to go, well, it's all a quantum world. Well, then what about relativity? You know, relativity is right, quantum mechanics is right, but the two don't work together. Now what? String theory comes in and tries to sort of be an answer. And I think what string theory did well was it was of the subatomic. It said, there's a subatomic world, let's get into it. So it was like a good initial premise. I think string theory, the notion of, like the idea of calling them strings, was flawed. Saying that these amorphous strings, and they always just show them sort of this little flexing, like a little worm flexing, you know. I think that idea, as a way to sort of convey the theory, was terrible. It doesn't match with what we know, and it doesn't allow for a lot of things. It doesn't match the energy. We're saying the energy of these springs is gargantuan. So gargantuan, it's almost incomprehensible. Like a billion billion times more energy than other energies like protons and neutrons and things like that. Like these springs are ultra massive, ultra powerful, and yet we're portraying them as these wishy-washy little worms, these springs. So I think that was a mistake, hence in my theory I call them springs rather than string. The other thing was that string theory was worried about the math. And when they tried to come up with a theory that explained everything including gravity, the theory, they get divided by zeros and they get infinities and they get infinite probabilities. And probabilities showing me, you know, what are the chances of something happen? Zero at one end, 100% likely at the other end. That should be your range, zero to 100%. String theory was getting infinities, infinite probabilities, and didn't like that, and had some revolutionary leaps which involved multiple dimensions, more than the three space one-time dimensions, more than 3 plus 1 as they call it, and saying there are 10 and even 11 dimensions. And then leading to M-brains, the M-space, Calabi-Yau shapes, and a great deal of complexity. you know, awesome for the math guys, all the complexity, and horrible for trying to visualize the world. In my opinion, horrible. And so string theory has basically created more questions than answers in my mind. And it's gone through some revolutions, there's been some breakthroughs, relative breakthroughs, and so it's still somewhat alive. Some people are very convinced of it. I think it's, you know, very future looking, and we just haven't figured it all out yet. And that's kind of a convenient way to describe it, so that who's to say, right? But I think it's at a bit of a dead end. And I think we need, that's why I sort of went back to the beginning of it in the coining the name spring and loop theory. I was basically saying, they're not strings, that's not descriptive, let's call them springs. And I've introduced something else, the loop. Using the simplest example I can think of, you know those building blocks that kids play with that I don't want to say the commercial word for? Well, those commercial building blocks, they have a positive and a negative part to them. One part interlocks with another part. And I think you need both those parts. I think it's ridiculous to say, yeah, we got these amorphous worms. Everything is amorphous worms. And that's how you get this world and this solid table is all through amorphous worms. I think that's ridiculous. And I cannot believe that that was ever proposed. What I say is, you have this table from building blocks. You have everything from building blocks. And it's really sort of the size of the blocks determines the size of things. And you can, those blocks can make bigger blocks, and those bigger blocks can make even bigger blocks. For example, we have some small blocks that make atoms. We have atoms that make molecules. We have molecules that make cellulose, which is a long chain, million atom, typically length fiber. And when you have a whole bunch of these million atom fibers, you get what wood is made of. And when you have a whole bunch of these wooden fibers, you get this tabletop. So this tabletop, from atoms to this tabletop, is easy to imagine with building blocks. Things that join to other things. So, springs need to join to something else. And at the time that I've been researching this in the last year and a year and a half, this is 2012-2013, it started just generally becoming accepted that gravitons, these mysterious gravitons, are loops. I don't really know what the, forgotten what the origin of that concept was, who came up with it, and what's the basis of it, but it makes a lot of sense to me. So let's go with it for the moment. The gravitons are loops, and there's something else which is springs, and so now we have a loop spring system. We have a building block system. If you think about it, look at a chain link fence. A chain link fence is interlocking segments. What we could think of as loops and springs. Now, technically, a chain link fence is one piece of metal going this way and another piece going this way, and then you have interlocking pieces going the other way. And so I think I got that wrong. It's a piece of metal this way, and another interlocks with it here, and then another interlocks here, and it's purely interlocking vertical pieces. And you can build this entire fence, but still, at the granular scale, if you just sampled a part of the fence, you could say that basically that fence is one thing looping into another thing, a loop and fastener kind of an approach. So that's the core essence of my theory. Welcome to the second video in the Spring and Loop Theory series. Here's the web address to read about the whole theory and try and introduce it to you today. In the first video, I gave you an introduction of basically saying there's a lot of problems in physics, sort of whichever theory you choose, there's a downside to it. Some of the new alternatives like string theory and some of their weaknesses. And then I hinted at what's the basis of my theory, spring and loop theory, what's the basis of it, and that's where we're at. So, and I sort of hinted that this Newton's cradle, this concept of these balls that ricochet like that, are at the core of spring loop theory. So I'm going to put that over there. I'm going to move this out of the way. I'm using a video format so that I can try and illustrate using my hands, gesticulating, rather than just the voice or just the text. So this is the essence of spring and loop theory. Spring and loop theory says that there's something smaller than the subatomic. I mean, we pretty much physics accepts that. And it's entirely reasonable. I don't think that's really a challengeable issue, not a big deal. So So there's something smaller. What is it? I'm saying that if this is space, empty space as they call it, I'm saying that this space is full of springs. Now, they're not physical springs, but the metaphor, the concept of a spring is the closest thing that I can think of to describe what these things are that are out there. So let me elaborate a little bit. So I'm saying that in space, every unit of space, every inch of space is filled, and it's filled with energy. These springs representing energy. These are some sort of a bundle of energy. In other words, the energy doesn't just sort of mix and suddenly the whole space is the same. Like having ice cubes and then the ice cubes melt and suddenly you have all water. I'm saying it's not like that. For some reason, these bundles of energy maintain their own integrity. Much like a proton does, much like a planet does, much like a galaxy does. There's some element of integrity to those things. And I'm saying at the core layer, there's some integrity. There's some structure, in quotes, it's not a physical structure, but some structure that is maintained over long periods of time. I call that the universal matrix. Universal, the universe, a matrix. The concept of a matrix is, you know, like a honeycomb matrix. You have the little honeycomb cells that every single inch of that honeycomb, of that, what do they call them? The supers, the hives, they have those, I'm not sure what the individual units are called. Anyway, those individual boards with the wax starter on them, they're laid out in a honeycomb arrangement, and that honeycomb arrangement fills the board perfectly. It's one of these mathematically sort of beautiful shapes, the hexagonal shape, that you can fill a space with hexagons and completely occupy. So that's where the word matrix comes from, and universal is as they offer. So I'm saying there's a universal matrix. It's a matrix of bundles of energy, or if you want to think of them as springs. And unlike springs, these bundles of energy are self-powered. This is, again, a concept that I cannot easily give an analogy or an explanation where you go, oh yeah, that's why they're like that. Because this is one of the, I think, the more interesting things about life, about the universe, is that at its lowest level are its highest energies. Now in our world, bigger is better, right? Follow the money. You know, the person with more money is, we respect that person more, we listen to them more, we think they're better. You know, the person is stronger, we think they're better. The person that runs faster, everything, the bigger it is, the better it is, we think. And yet the weird thing is, the more you delve into particle physics, getting back to when you try and contain that electron, and when you try and contain it, it gets more energetic. Finally, to the point of breaking out of that smaller box. This is not intuitive. But again, it seems to be sort of a core property of the way life works. So, universal matrix of springs. Each of these springs are a self-contained energy source. So, given that sort of premise, that sort of a what the premise, let's elaborate on it just a little bit so that we understand what I'm referring to. What are these springs? What are these quanta? What are these chunks of energy that that space, that light, everything is filled with? I'm saying that they're basically a pulsing, vibrating, spring-like source of ultra-intense energy. This is something that is a little hard to convey. In string theory, this is, you know, borrowing from string theory, where string theory says that strings are very high energy. The amount of energy is like on the order of like a million billion times the energy of a proton. So a string, even though it's like a million billion times smaller, it has a million billion times more energy. Unintuitive. It's the way it is. That's it. It's a very, very tiny level. So we have these things, and these things, basically, just think of them like a spring. Just each of these little pockets of space, each of these little honeycomb matrix entries, each of these little springs is doing this. It's just pounding away in the most intense way you can imagine, and then make it a billion times bigger. Maybe think of them like little nuclear bombs, only where a nuclear bomb goes out and doesn't come back in. These are going out and in constantly. So it's high energy, constant, and in pocket. This, I'm saying, is the core structure of the universe. The universal matrix is these springs. Energized, oscillating, pulsating, vibrating springs. Now, you know, it's somewhat new maybe. It's sort of based on string theory and kind of has some convenient things. For example, that universal matrix explains what is dark energy. I'm saying that dark energy, as we're measuring it, is this spring energy, this background energy. And by the way, this is one of these conundrums of physics, that the background energy of life should be very high. It should be 120 orders of magnitude higher than what they're measuring. And they can't detect this 120 orders of magnitude. They only detect this, you know, cold background. Well, what I'm saying is that this background energy, this spring's oscillating energy, this matrix, is so small, is at such a small granularity, it's so tiny, each of these individual pockets, that it would be like an elephant trying to count grains of sand. How would an elephant count grains of sand? He could count rocks, you know, he could count boulders or rocks, but when you get him down to the level of sand, he can't count it. Therefore, he can't see it. Therefore, you start talking about sand, and hey, Mr. Elephant, we'll pay you with sand. He's like, I don't think so, because it's too small. So, all right, so that's our basis. Empty space is filled with springs, filled with chunks, quanta of energy at the smallest scale. And this energy is bouncing against each other, but everyone pushes equally. Think of it like an army, a very large, very tiny army that is constantly ready to fight, let's say. Now, we don't have mass yet. We don't have things yet. We just have this energy. The mass, in my theory, are the loops. Generally accepted now that gravitons are loops. Again, where does it come from? I think the way I would explain it is this, using a chemistry model. In chemistry, you have solids, liquids, and gases. And they represent increases of energy. Solids have less energy, and then you heat it up and you get a liquid, and then you get a gas. But it also represents the affinity of something that it has for itself. For example, if you have lead, it's a solid. If you have mercury, it's a liquid. Now, they're both metals. They both have a lot of the properties of metals. But this metal, when it's with itself, it's very comfortable and stable and cold or low energy. This metal, mercury, when it's with itself, it's a little bit more willing to go somewhere else. It's a little bit less tied up. And then you have maybe a third element, whatever you want to choose. You could choose one of the noble ones, for example, and they're always gases, even when you try and cool them down very cold. Helium, you've got to cool it down to something like 4 degrees Kelvin, 269 degrees below zero Celsius, super cold, before helium will become a liquid, and then something like a fraction of a degree or 1 degree or something before helium will become a solid. So the point I'm making is that it's a bit same basic stuff. You can't just easily point to say, well, lead is obviously different than mercury, is different than helium or neon or xenon or argon or krypton. Really, at their core, each of them is a nucleus. Each of them has protons, each of them has neutrons, each of them has electrons flying around, or in some way electrons are in the picture. But you have three different things. Putting it another way, if you start with electrons, protons, and neutrons, a bunch of them, you can end up with solids, you can end up with liquids, and you can end up with gases. So, life is basically energy, vibration if you will, but energy we'll say. So we have a universal matrix of energy, think of that as the gas in my analogy. And then think of the loops being the liquid, something that's a little lower in energy, a little more stable, a little bit more comfortable with itself. And in the energy scale, if gases are the hottest and liquids are more medium temperatures, solids tend to be colder. So the universal matrix is high energy. Mass is more medium energy or cooler energy. and then there's maybe something else that's even a lower energy. So let's go with that. What I'm trying to do here is by using a comparison with chemistry, between chemistry and physics, just to show you that in a given system, with a pot of stuff, you can come up with different things from it. You can come out with solids, liquids, and gases, and you can come out of it with chunks of energy and loops. Yes, these are energy loops. Everything is energy. Mass and energy are interchangeable, thanks to Einstein. But it's physically, or it has the properties of a loop, and as such, it now behaves differently than a gas, or than a ball of energy, an amorphous, undefined ball of energy. So what do we get? We have these springs, these energetic springs, and we're going to introduce the smallest unit of gravity, of mass, into the system. I shouldn't say the smallest unit of gravity. It'll create the least gravity, but it's the smallest unit of mass. A single loop. We're going to introduce a single loop into this system. And what happens? Now, for the metaphor, I'm going to use... This is my where I need to have a video more than anything. Let me just get a pen here. I can see how prepared I am. So, we have a spring world, and I can't easily represent those, but I can represent the loop. And we have these springs. Maybe I'll just represent them with creatively with the letter S. And these S's want to go in and out. They are moving in and out or vibrating in every direction. I don't know if they're very direction limited. There's not really any reason for them to be. So these S's, these springs, can move in all directions. And we introduce a loop into the picture. And by the way, this is a matrix of springs, so we're saying this whole page is filled with these springs. And we've introduced one loop now. What happens? This spring, when it wants to move this way, it hits something that's not like it, not like the others. Right? When this spring hits this spring, they bounce off each other, basically. They bang back and forth, and nothing happens. Here, the spring loop interaction, I'm saying that this spring can interact with this loop. It can do a number of things. But primarily, it can get tangled or wrap around this loop. The analogy that I use is people dancing. They're on a dance floor, and you have, let's say it's a very energetic dance or music, like rock music or something like that, or just something extremely high energy and independent. In other words, each person is dancing independently. Maybe think of it like Woodstock. Mr. Richie Havens passed away yesterday. Let's dedicate this story to him, or this analogy to him. Let's say we're at Woodstock and we're listening to Richie Havens playing Freedom, and you have individuals dancing in the crowd. Okay, and they're just throwing their arms around, they're dancing randomly. And you introduce a loop, and now a loop, we're saying, we're changing the performer. Richie Havens is finished, and now the next performer is playing a slow song. In this slow song, suddenly people, maybe it's a love song, more romantic, and people want to dance together with each other. And so now, instead of individuals sort of just doing their own thing, now we have an individual, another individual, and they join, right? They put their arms around each other, right? And this being Woodstock, maybe they do join in some way other than just putting their arms around each other. But we'll just say, one of them's a loop. You know, the male and the female, isn't it interesting that the male and the female symbols, there's the female and there's the male. Isn't it interesting that one is sort of maybe can be thought of as like a spring and the other is more a loop, right? Anyway, imagine. In our story, we have a person here and a person there, and they join together now. Instead of pulsating around, they're like this. My question to you is, what happens now on the dance floor, the Woodstock dance floor, what happens when people start doing this? These people start taking up less space than the people that are dancing wildly and freely. People are dancing wildly and freely, yes, they're moving around more, and they can throw their arms up, and they're taking up a lot of space. People that are dancing cheek to cheek or holding each other, you know, like a waltz or whatever, or just a slow dance, they're not taking up as much space. And in fact, what you can say is, around these people, space is contracted. They have made room within their space for something additional. you could fit something else near these people and it wouldn't break. You could put a little china cup next to them, a little small table, and put a teapot on there and a couple of teacups, and it would fit there and they wouldn't break it. The person thrashing their arms around would break it. Well, what are we saying in all that? What I'm saying is, that's how gravity works. Gravity is a contraction of space. When you introduce a loop, it pulls this S towards the O. It pulls this spring towards the O because part of the spring wraps around the O. If you think of a spring is a piece of metal that is, because of its energy, gets coiled. If you wrap that spring around something, then it shortens itself. If you stretch it out, it's long. If it's wrapped around something, it can be quite short. The loop, spring loop interaction is a shortening. Things get closer together or shorter. So, on the dance floor, if everyone starts dancing like this spring and this loop are, they get closer together and you gain space or you contract space. Both of those being equivalent, strangely enough. So, how does gravity propagate? Well, let's redraw this. Now let's see something interesting. I'll do a dot, 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 spring, 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 dot, dot, dot. There's our loop. There's another spring, 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 dot, dot, dot. This is a highly simplified diagram. Save our springs. And what it's basically saying is, where we had a uniform universal matrix of springs, when we've introduced this loop here, we have things near it are being pulled towards it. They are being attracted to it, maybe like tape of some kind or something sticky, or, you know, the stickiness of romance, of love, right? Brings people together. Gravity is like love, right? It's attractive. One of the few, you know, love and gravity are the only attractive forces I know of. Oh, actually, that's not true. Magnetism, or positive and negative charge, electromagnetism. But, as we'll see, I think that's related. Okay, so what we have here is something familiar. This is curved space. Space being the springs, and now we have curved space in the presence of mass. What I'm saying is when you introduce loops into a spring system, you get a contraction of space, not a warping or stretching, you get a contraction of space. In fact, when you say gravity stretches space, it's guaranteed wrong. It's always contracted. It's always a shrinking. And this is what makes gravity attract. It's always puzzled me, the attractive force. How could you conceive of it? And so, what does this say? There's some profound implications of spring and loop theory right away. Number one, there is an ether. The ether is the springs. Number two, we know what dark energy is. It's the springs. Number three, you know how gravity works. Number four, we see that gravity is contracted. It's not this warping business. And so right away, that those words have to be changed. Another thing we see is the bowling ball metaphor. We say that, you know, if this is space and if you have the sun in the middle, it pushes down. And so that's what causes the Earth to rotate around, is that you have this bowling ball pushing down on a flexible membrane, and it causes other balls to rotate around it. Now we realize that that's wrong. I mean, we already know it's wrong, but now we realize that conceptually we can do one better. And so maybe we can call this the dance floor model, where on the dance floor, when you dance a slow dance, that's gravity. That's love, right? I mean, they are exactly similar behavior, right? Okay. So that's the essence of spring and loop theory. And as I say, there are a lot of repercussions that just spill out of this theory. So this theory is kind of a boom, here's this big new change, and then, these are all the realizations that come with it. All right, this is the third stage of the third lecture in the Spring and Loop Theory series. That's the website if you wanted to go and check out the full explanation, the full concept, Spring and Loop Theory. Today, I wanted to sort of review a little bit, and then I wanted to do a bit more new stuff. So, we talked about the idea that there are loops, and there's a spring matrix, and that a loop contracts the spring matrix in the vicinity of the loop. I think I haven't really talked about what is the spring matrix. I think that I have the ability to talk about what is the speed of light, and it relates to the spring matrix. I think the spring, the speed of light is the propagation time through the matrix. So the reason why this ball is significant is, what is the propagation time when this ball hits this ball? How long does it take before this ball comes up? So we'll just watch it. And it seems instantaneous. But there is some amount of time. I don't know what it is. It's some, you know, few thousands of a second or something like that. It takes time, once this ball hits, for another ball to come up. And so I'm saying the same thing is happening in the universal matrix of springs. Is that when one spring is hit by some energy, it transfers it to the next one and the next one, and it transfers it through the matrix. This is why we can see light across empty space. It's being propagated through these springs. So, talking about what is the speed of light, I haven't heard anyone else do it. It falls naturally out of this theory. The Big Bang. Spring loop theory has caused me to be skeptical about the Big Bang. One of the things I'm most skeptical about is they have this issue where space seems to be uniform and expanding everywhere. There doesn't seem to be any center, called the horizon problem. So my question is, if there was a bang, there should be an explosion in the center, and we should be able to say, this is where it started and exploded up from here. And there's just no here in this universe that we have. With my springs, these energetic springs, I say that these energetic springs are hitting each other constantly. And they are gradually hitting each other and going apart. If you put a whole bunch of super balls in a bag, and these super balls were energized like these, self-energized, and the bag was gossamer thin, it was like a weather balloon bag, let's say, after a while, those balls would make the bag get bigger. It's absolutely a natural consequence. So I think that the expansion of the universe is caused by these springs colliding with each other. Now the Big Bang has this issue where it's supposedly an explosion. They have just a number of issues, and so they created the idea of there's an explosion, and then there's an inflation period where things happen very rapidly. You might say everyone gets in place very quickly, and then life carries on. And this is out of necessity because the temperature in the universe is very uniform. Throughout the whole universe, temperature is very uniform. And if you have an explosion, the one thing you don't have is uniform temperature. So this is where the traditional explosion theory just is absolute rubbish to me. And this is a much more intelligent, because basically this says these are energized springs, energized all the time. Think of it like boiling water. And with boiling water, it's gradually expanding, if you will. Maybe not a perfect analogy, but better certainly than the Big Bang theory. One of the things about spring and loop theory is that you start to be able to see some connections that weren't there before. We're starting to get some extra information. If the spring, what I call the bump speed, is the speed of light, and if we have some idea of how powerful these springs are, earlier I had sort of estimated, tried to go from memory of how powerful they are. Strings, according to string theory, the strings are 100 billion times smaller than a proton. That's 10 to the 20. And yet they're 10 to the 20 times more energetic. And so now we have how energetic these things are, and then we have a time of how long does it take for the light to travel through the system. And I think that starts to make it more feasible to calculate how big these things are or how far apart these things are. And we're starting to get some properties of these springs through this theory. Now, the cosmic microwave background. Well, if you say there's a bang, and yet there's the space is 2.7 degrees Kelvin, how come? And they say, well, that's the residual temperature from the Big Bang. My intuition says 15 billion years after an explosion, you don't have any temperature. That's it, period. And it just doesn't make sense. 15 billion years, you're going to see some temperature. That's a fire. You know, the fire goes out, but it 15 billion years later, you can measure some heat from the fire. I think that when these springs are banging against each other constantly, as I maintain they are, and they're doing it everywhere all the time, that creates heat. That is your 2.7 degrees Kelvin. It's the background heat from these springs going all the time. Another interesting thing I just read on the 148 question Wikipedia page on the greatest problem in physics, and it was talking about how there's a space roar, and this roar is 6 times louder than it's supposed to be. It's 6 times louder than calculated. Well, again, this is just one of these many problems in physics. They calculate something and oops, it's not what they calculate. How come? They don't know why. Well, it seems reasonable to me that these things that are ultra energetic, imagine 10 to the 20 times more powerful than a proton, and basically 10 to the 20 times more of them, because they're much smaller, 10 to the 20 times smaller. Isn't it possible that that could make some noise? I mean, remember I said that these interactions are almost like a nuclear bomb interaction. They're so energetic. Maybe they're even more energetic. And if you have all these, you know, things going on, even in the vacuum of space where there are no air molecules, and sound only goes through air, it makes some noise, despite that, just because it's so darned energetic. And now, I wanted to sort of do the finale, and the finale is that I think the spring and loop theory, I can start to say what are the four forces. The four forces, conventionally thought of as the strong force, the weak force, electromagnetic, and gravity. Strong force is the gluons in a nucleus of an atom that keep the atom together. The glue, easy to remember. And the weak force is the weak gauge bosons and something else, I think, that they say it's mostly involved in radioactive decay. So if you have a nucleus and it decays, the weak force is involved. So radioactivity, like the nuclear bomb dropped in Nagasaki, Hiroshima, was a weak force exploiting the weak force, not the strong force. And I suppose the nuclear fusion, the next level up from fission, is the one that's probably tapping into the strong force. I'm not certain about that. So those are the two nuclear forces. They get weaker as you get away from the nucleus, and physicists have always said, why? I'll show you why. Third one, electromagnetism. Electricity and magnetism unified by James Clerk Maxwell. We unified those two forces. I took my last name because of Mr. Maxwell and what he accomplished. I changed my name. So electromagnetism, that's the force that we see everywhere. Think of it like, you know, like the bloodstream of life. It's absolutely everywhere, and everything we do, everything, you know, we can't do anything without it. And in things like when you see light, when sound propagates, and all these different things, they're all doing it through the electromagnetic force. So consider it the most well-known, the most common, the most easily understood. In the time of Einstein, I don't think that Einstein knew about it at that time, about the strong and weak force. All he knew about was the electromagnetic and gravity. And even then, Einstein was bothered yet. The electromagnetic force and gravity, and the two were not unified, and that bothered him. I'll show you how they unified. So finally, the fourth force, of course, is gravity. So this is what spring and loop theory says. The strong force that glues the nucleus together, what is it? It loops. It's a spring looping around the loop. That is the strong force. It's the strongest of all the four forces. It is the most fundamental bond in the universe, because it's taken the most powerful thing, a spring, and it's binding it. So naturally, the strong force is the strong one. And naturally, it's a gluing force. It makes total sense. The weak force is not hard to think about, not hard to imagine when you think, okay, we have a loop and a spring system, a building block system, and that's an atom. What happens when you break it apart? You know, the analogy I use is if you have a weightlifter and he lifts a weight up and then he drops it, that is the weak force. So it takes a great amount of energy to lift, you know, 400, 800 pounds some of these guys can lift. So think of that energy as a strong force. The letting go of it, when it hits the ground, when it hits the mat, and you know, you kind of don't want to be nearby, and probably see chips of wood or whatever the base material is made of kind of flying, because there is some force involved there. They're dropping the weight and you want to get out of the way. But it's nothing like the force that was required to lift them in the first place. And sure enough, the weak force is, as they say, you know, they say it's primarily related to radioactive decay. So when you have these super strong things coming together, when they let go, think of it like a fire hose. This thing lets go and it's going to fly around until it grabs onto something else, right? And in that process of flying around, that's the weak force. electromagnetism, electromagnetic force, getting back to this universal matrix, I say that this is everywhere, and I say that everything that propagates through this matrix, everything that bumps its way through it, of all the different frequencies and energies, is electromagnetism, is the electromagnetic force. That's why it's everywhere. That's why everything we do sort of requires that force, because we live in, it's like living in water, and then you would say the electromagnetism in water is like maybe viscosity, the stickiness of water. The stickiness of water affects everything that's in the water. When you try and travel through water, that viscosity slows your boat down more than it does in air, a great, great deal more. So viscosity kind of dominates water, sort of that way. So the gravity is the subtle one of the four. No wonder it hasn't been, you know, sort of figured out. No wonder they have so many theories. No wonder they are looking for gravity particles, which is ridiculous. Because it's an effect. It's a subtle effect of taking this spring and tying these two springs up with one loop. It's a subtle, small effect. But, and this is something that's testable and simulatable, if the universal matrix is like a fence, the loop string interaction here is like clamping part of the fence. If you hook up sensors at the ends of the fence and then you clamp part of it, you will feel a gravity effect here. It will slightly compress that fence. Or maybe a better analogy, instead of a fence, because the fence is not exactly all dimensions, might be a fishnet. You took a giant fishnet, sort of tensed it out, and if you just compressed part of that fishnet and then measured the effect everywhere, I think you will find it is a gravity-like effect. A slight effect on, and this effect propagates. This spring is contracted close to the loop. It means this spring is also sort of drawn. He has more space, so he tends to go this way towards the space, and this one tends to go this way, and this one tends to go this way. And that's a slight attractive force. So, there are the four forces. Notice how they are all tied to one force. They're all related to you have loops, you have springs, so the strong is the spring binding, the weak force is the spring letting go, so it's the same force there. The electromagnetic is, you have all these springs of energy, these S's are these springs of energy, and everything, all interactions are related to these springs of energy bumping and transmitting these bumps through the spring matrix. So once again, the springs are central to the explanation. And then finally, gravity is finding a way to contract part of this matrix of springs, and what's the effect of that. So unification through this theory. Finally, in the realm of things this theory doesn't explain, one of them I'm puzzling about is what is the neutrino? And I think that, if you recall initially, I was talking about gas, liquids, and solids in chemistry, and how the high energy, the gases of my system are the springs, the liquids are the loops, and maybe the solids are the neutrinos. That's why they're weakly interacting. That's why they can go through a light year of lead and only 50% of them get absorbed, type thing. Is that maybe a neutrino is a ball. And if you notice, you have springs and loops, you get a strong bond. But what happens when you have this system and you have a ball? Think of it like a cannonball. And there is talk that neutrinos are quite a bit smaller. And I forget the numbers, but in essence, what if the neutrinos are smaller than these bundles of energy, these springs of energy? Wouldn't it be easy to imagine them just simply, you know, passing in or around these larger objects? Let's say these are trees in a forest. And what if the neutrino was a bullet? You can imagine it avoiding the trees. And so that's just something to think about, it just to show that, you know, spring and loop theory is not trying to claim that it understands everything. And also, what I'm trying to say is that there's a great deal of uncharted territory. There's life that we understand well. There's some bigger stuff we don't understand as well. There's very microscopic stuff that we understand very poorly. And as an order of magnitude problem, it's like saying we manage our own finances well. When it gets to the national debt, we've definitely got issues. But when it gets to the micropayment system, you know, a Bitcoin-like system or some other, you know, PayPal or some other micro system, we're really out to lunch. and we really have no idea what anybody is doing. And we have to accept that. That has to be built into our physics, how it's taught and how it's portrayed, because otherwise right now on TV we get this, isn't it all wonderful, we've got it all figured out, this is how it is, and let's just marvel and go, oh gee, I'm so dumb and this is all so wonderful and smart and profound. It's not quite so clear cut. And I think if we taught it in a way that said, this isn't all known, we have theories and our theories are getting better, but it isn't all known stuff. And I think if we taught that way, people would go, well, then I want to, maybe I can carve out a niche, maybe I can figure some part of this out. And that would be a bit more, less of an exclusive club, and a bit more encouraging to everyone to learn a bit more physics. So, Spring and Loop Theory, there it is in a nutshell. There's the website. And thank you for listening.